title of this tape is The Arnold S. Griffin Family Memoirs. It concerns the self-sufficient nature of the Griffin family in the late 1800s and early 1900s. This tape discusses how different family responsibilities were handled, with emphasis on the winter hog killing. The narrator is Mr. Arnold S. Griffin. The interview was conducted by his daughter, Helen Ruth Griffin, on Sunday afternoon of July 1, 1973, at the Griffin home located 3 miles west of Devine.
Well, I'm going to talk about a little of my life growing up out here on these here dry land farms out west of Devine, Texas, about 6 miles in Medina County, where I was raised. We lived about a mile from the school. And before my time, my granddaddy came to this country from Indiana. He crossed over Gainesville in 1839 and came to Bandera, Texas with my grandmother. And there he was engaged in splitting shingles out of cypress along the Medina River to make houses. He was a millwright and a carpenter and a blacksmith and a farmer and a cowman and a horseman. His horse brand was a half circle G bar, and I still have the iron. I use that brand myself. My daddy never used the brand. He used a cross slash on the left side of the cow. But I took up that half circle G bar on the left hip, and I have the old branding iron that is made in Castroville when it was a young town by Negley, who was a blacksmith there, back long before the turn of a century. After my granddaddy lived at the old Mormon camp, he was one of these hardshell Baptists, but he was lived along the banks of the Medina River there at the Mormon camp out of Bandera. And then he later on moved down to Medina County and lived right west of the Francisco Schoolhouse, which was west of what's now the city of Devine. And this was out about a mile from Devine. Devine was originated when the Ingen Railroad come through. And old Judge Devine, we had a section there. Judge Devine was sort of instrumental in getting that through. He was in San Antonio, and they named the town Devine after him. And then they moved the schoolhouse from Francisco over to that. But my daddy was born right there west of Devine on what's now part of the old Lily tract of land, now owned by John Watson, who, by the way, now is president of the Bremer Association in South Texas. And he lived there some 2 or 3 years and then moved up here to where we live now. He bought a piece of land there, and they said sell half of it to pay for the other half. Times was hard in them days.
What year was that?
That was in 1871 when we moved up there where I was raised and where my daddy was raised after he was born right west of Devine. Bought this tract of land pretty cheap, but had to sell half of it to pay for the rest of it. Times was hard. And then they went to Castroville with wagon and team, ox wagon, and they brought back enough lumber for $150 to build a house. It'd cost you now $15,000 to build. And my granddaddy and his older sons, Albert and Jack Griffin, and Dave Griffin, and then my daddy was next and had 2 older daughters, settled there. While he was building this house, one incident there, was that they was framing it up, and well, I believe they were fixing to put shingles on the house. And a bunch of wild turkeys come by there, and Monster Jack, he was a young fella, and couldn't find any shot to put in his old musket to kill one of these turkeys, so he grabbed up a handful of shingle nails and loaded that old muzzle loader and went out there and shot one of them turkeys and shot down about half a pear bush. Them little square shingle nails cut holes through them pear bushes, they said, for 30, 40 feet around that turkey. But they got the turkey anyhow. And another thing, the whole family was carpenters. And I guess that's where I got my carpenter instinct and contractor instinct. And one of the long suits of my granddaddy was, as soon as he framed up a house and got the studding and the plates on, he stood on his head on the corner of the house. And I always did that on the houses I frame. And even in Divine alone, built some 300 houses. And every time we get the plate up, even after I got to where didn't do too much of the work on the house, wasn't available, somebody else was doing the work. If I was around when we raised the plate, I stood on the corner on my head. That's just a habit. And I still do. Built a log cabin at Folklife Festival last year, Texas' first Folklife Festival. When we got the plate up, I stood on the corner, on my head on the corner.
That's supposed to show how level
you are. That's to show, yeah, how plumb and level you are, yeah. Your sense of balance and so forth, and sense of knowledge of the plumb line. But anyhow, what I was going back to, times was pretty hard, and they grubbed that land. I'd grubbed out 100 acres of field on this place, and brought a bunch of Mexicans out of Mexico. Didn't make much difference about immigration in them days at all. And granddaddy and my daddy and went to Mexico and brought a train load. That's where they told me, a train load of Mexicans out of Mexico. Put them to grubbing up in this country. And they grubbed out 100 acres of land, and Uncle Albert, who was my daddy's brother, took them, and they grubbed out all kinds of land north of there for contract work. But all of this was done with hand labor, and then they had lots of mules. And the ordinary rate of pay for a man in those days was 50 cents a day. He'd give him a turning plow, an 8-inch turning plow, and a span of mules, and he plowed with a walking plow for 50 cents a day. And the big idea in grubbing this thing out was to plant cotton. This part of Texas was a coming cotton country, and everybody thought cotton was it. And so we planted lots of cotton. You know, they made more clothes out of cotton. By now, synthetic stuff is taking over everything. But it was a pretty hard life on the farm. They didn't have any screen doors on the houses. And, them old dogs would come in around under the cook stove. You had to close the door, and it was too hot, and they'd let them in. In the wintertime, I know Jim Smith and Uncle Dave and a bunch of them boys would come around to go coon hunting and cat hunting, bringing them old dogs down there. And Aunt Molly was my daddy's sister. She's old maid, but she had sort of taken over the cooking, and she was in charge of the cooking. This before my mother was in the family. And then them dogs got up under the stove. She always had a pretty good remedy to get them out, because there was always a boiling tea kettle on the stove, and she'd accidentally spill a little bit of that hot water over there on them old hounds, and boy, they'd move out of there. She had to be careful, didn't turn the stove over, knock down the stove pipe. But this part of Texas had some pretty trying times. And another thing was pretty hard was the washing that had to take place.
Did you ever have to help with the washing?
Yeah, I had to help pack water. My goodness, when I was growing up, I had to pack water. I want to bring my mother into this. I told you a while back that little schoolhouse was about mile and a half from the old house, and my mother was an orphan girl, and she came to Divine from Robertson County when she was young and stayed with some people down there. And when she graduated from high school, one of her uncles died and left her $100 to her part of the estate. She took this $100 and went to San Marcos Teachers College, which was normal at that time. In 1905, she graduated from that normal and got her certificate and come back to Divine and hunted up school to teach, and she got Shookville School, which was a country school out here in this district of Medina County, and she hunted a place to stay, and she got room and board up there at my daddy's house and my granddaddy's house. And while she was there teaching school, well, my daddy, I guess, fell in love with her and needed to cook, so he married her. And she come into the family from that time on. She never did teach anymore after he married her. It wasn't like these nowadays. It took both of them to make a living. If you couldn't make it on your own, if the man in the house couldn't make a living, they just both starved to death together, I guess. But then they always managed it.
How did y'all get wash when y'all washed?
Well, they washed clothes in the time when rain was available. Well, my mother always had a bunch of barrels sitting around the gutter to the eaves of the house, and they filled those barrels full of rainwater, because rainwater is good to wash clothes with. And they were pretty particular about how they washed the clothes. But when dry time came, well, we had a big old dirt tank out northwest of the house, about 40, 50 yards. It's still there, up there. You can go up there and see it. And we'd go down there, and that water would settle, you know, and they'd carry that water out of there and put the big wash pot up there and build a fire under it and boil that water and boil them clothes back and forth and get them cleaned out and hang them on the clothesline to dry.
What kind of soap did they have?
Had lye soap.
Make
the lye soap out of fried meat grease and any kind of grease as waste from the table. You mix that with lye and made out of ashes and cook it down and make lye soap. And we always kept the bottom of the pot. It never would turn to soap. It was sort of an oil, just slick as glass. We used that for grease wagon wheels and different things, like if we wanted to skid something. You pour a little soft soap on a long pole or something like that, and you can just skid anything heavy right across that. So we used that soft soap in there, and they used the other soap for washing purposes. And it was good soap, especially in that rainwater and tank water.
Did y'all use the same soap to bathe with, or did they make bar soap?
Used the same soap to bathe with.
Lye didn't hurt you?
No, there wasn't enough lye in it to hurt anything. The lye was used up and then greasy it up when it made the soap. So it was just like soap.
Did you have ashes? Is that how you
mixed
it up too? Did you have
mixed
ashes?
Well, you burn the ashes to make the lye. Of course, in later years, we bought the lye already made. Indian head lye. Nickel a can. Can of lye makes a pot of soap.
How'd you bleach
that?
Did you ever bleach anything?
Well, yes, bleach the mess, just hang it out in the sun. It bleaches, it'll turn white. It still will. Turn nearly anything white. You can
what
take
it. Did you make it?
Made most of the clothing. And,
by hand, or did you get sewing
machine? Oh, no. I never can remember a time when my mother didn't have a good Singer sewing machine. It was a Treadle sewing machine, but she could always sew good on that sewing machine. We had two sewing machines at the house all the time. My Aunt Molly had one and my mother had one. And they sewed on their own sewing machine and kept them on in shape. Nobody didn't have to oil them. Nobody didn't have to adjust them. They did that themselves. Now there's somebody always trying to hunt up somebody to just sewing machine. Looks to me like women ought to just own sewing machine.
Well, it's kind of like toys, and they get more complicated.
Well, they're not so much more complicated. That same old thing, a sewing machine, had just about as many parts as the one nowadays. All they have is cams on any different stitches, but in truth, it all matters to that if you're going to do a job, you need to learn why these things happen and learn to control them, adjust your own sewing machine. But I want to put in here a little bit about the ironing situation. My mother never would let me wear any clothes to school that wasn't ironed to perfection. And they might be worn a little bit, but they was clean and was ironed. And the iron in different ways. First irons I remember of was the old smoothing iron that you set on top of a wood stove, and they had a handle on every iron, and you just set about a six of them up there if you had that many. Then you had a rag in your hand to keep from burning your hand, and you picked them off of there with that rag and ironed a while till that one got cold, and you set it back on, got another one, and ironed till it got cold, set it back on, got another one. You just kept replacing, had a fire in the stove. You was probably cooking beans anyhow, or bread. And wood was cheap. Didn't cost anything. You didn't have any $100 electric bill like they do nowadays to air condition all these houses. We just raised the windows.
Didn't have electricity in the house?
Didn't have any electricity. It had kerosene lights. And we called it coal oil in them days. Coal oil was pretty potent, really. It was explodable, more so than now. Kerosene and diesel oil now are not so touches with a match as they were in those days. Maybe the gasoline wasn't refined out of it as much or something, but I know if a light got burning down in the globe, you took that thing down in the bowl, you took that thing out in the yard and put a sack over it and tried to smother it out, keep burning the house down. But all during school, well, and high school, that's the only kind of lights we had in the house was the kerosene lights. Of course, in 1933, REA come to this country, and that changed the way of the life of the farmers and ranchers in this country, and as far as I know, in all of the United States. It changed the way of ironing, too.
Yeah, but I guess we got electric.
Yeah, we had a good many irons, though, before we got an electric iron. My mother was always trying out something. She'd sell chickens or something, or eggs, and get a hold of a little money. And first, we had a demountable type of handle. It had a D-shaped handle made out of wood, and it had a clip on the bottom, and the irons were made where you just clipped that handle from one iron to another, and you still heated them on top of the stove. Then later on got one, a big old heavy iron that you put charcoal inside the iron and poured a little kerosene oil over to get it started.
And you had a fire inside the iron.
And you had a fire inside the iron, and that kept iron. That was a pretty good deal. It sort of worked on the same arrangement these barbecue pits do now, only we didn't have these little fancy briquettes. You had to burn your own charcoal. You just burned a bunch of logs and picked up the charcoal and put them in the iron.
You
had
a big opening at the top.
Well, you could take the top off of it and fill it full, and then you put the top back on, and it sort of had a half-hitch clamp that you clamped around, and then it stayed on there. And you used that thing a long time. And then we got out of Sears Roebuck catalogs, and Montgomery Ward both. They had the gasoline irons, made sort of like a blowtorch. They was iron, and you had to generate them on the inside. You had a little gasoline tank that held about a cup of gasoline. You filled that thing full of gasoline, and then you took a little pump, sort of like a bicycle pump, and you put on top of that thing and loosened the little valve, and you pumped that full air and shut this valve off, and that put pressure on the little tank. Then he let a little loose gasoline run out in this iron and struck a match to it. It burned sort of like alcohol for a while in there, and it warmed up the generator in this iron where it would stay lighted and burn a blue flame. Then you opened the valve just a little and turned on, and it put a real blue flame. And that was a good iron. And it cost about $12.30, pretty high in them days, but we managed to get a hold of one. 50 cents a day. 50 cents a day, not per hour, 50 cents a day. And we live probably as good a life or better than we live now. At least we is at peace of mind and not so many places to go.
What y'all do for recreation?
For recreation? Well, we've done lots of things for recreation. And let me get this ironing off here first. Then later on, of course, like I said, 1933, will the REA come in, and we had electric irons, and people didn't know how to handle electricity much in them days, and different things come up. I know up at Castleville, up above here in Alsace community, they was disturbed about electricity here and there and wondering how it was going and what was taking place. And one woman called up the REA and said, "Say, the little dog chewed mine in cordon two and electricity juice run all over the floor." And said he went out of the house howling, and I wondered if it would shock me to sweep it up. But, huh?
What'd she see?
Yeah. Electricity juice all over the floor. I feel that dog used the bathroom on the floor. But anyhow, those things come up, and now we have electricity and electric lights and changed our way of life. Refrigerators and deep freezers and kill our own beef and everything. Back in those days, talking about killing beef, well, we used to, the neighbors, different ones around, well, our neighbors weren't too close, but anytime one of the neighbors killed the beef, well, they'd quarter it all up and divide it up among the neighbors because you couldn't keep meat. And as long as we was raising cattle, we was going to eat beef. We still do. If they were $300 a piece, we still going to eat beef. And then the next time another neighbor would kill some beef, and he'd bring you over a piece of meat, and they'd divide it out that way, and we saved the meat there. We didn't have any deep freeze. But now, of course, after electricity, you got your own deep freeze, and you put whatever you wanted to in it.
How did you keep the meat you got?
Well, we kept lots of beef by curing it out, especially pork.
How do you cure?
In the wintertime, we would kill hogs, and I've seen as many as 8 big hogs hanging up at our house in one day when I was a boy. The first thing you do to kill a hog is, out at our place, we've got a big live oak tree with a block and tackle hanging up there over a limb that comes out, and right under that we bury the big barrel in the ground down about halfway, maybe 2 or 3 barrels. And then put another 2 or 3 barrels out here on the side, and build up a big fire around them and heat that water good and hot, and then hit them hogs in the head with the axe and drag them out there and raise them up, pour that hot water over in these barrels that's buried halfway in the ground, and that held the heat good. And then you dip them up and down in that and lay them out on a pair of sawhorses with an old garage door, an old buggy house door we had there. Just lay them up there on the table and scrape all the hair off of them. And
just with a knife?
Just with a knife or a hoe or sometimes a shovel, whatever Dad could find or we could find to get it off. You got it off there real quick while it was good and hot and flip it. It can take over about 10 minutes to scrape a hog when there's 3 or 4 people working on him and knew what they were doing. Of course, after you hit him in the head of the axe, first thing you done was stick him in the heart with a big butcher knife. My dad always prided himself, and I can do that too. Stick a hog and never get a drop of blood on your knife. Just reach in there and stick him right on the heart and pull it right out, and the blood follow you right out. I know one of these old Mexicans that we brought back from Mexico at that time, he grew up. In fact, he just died a year or two ago. He was 90-something years old, Felipe Lopez. When he was growing up, as soon as you stick that hog, he'd run there with a tin cup and get that cup full of hot blood and drink it. I got to where I could drink a cup of that blood, but after I grew up and found out it wasn't such a hot, and we just did it because Felipe would do it. And it was all the women running the house when they go drinking the blood. But anyhow, it was hard work killing them hogs, because after you killed them and hung them up, you usually kill about eight. I've seen as many as eight. Sometimes it wouldn't kill over two or three. Try to kill enough for the winter. On a cold day, you wait till the cold north blows in. You didn't want too much rain, because that's hard on curing meat, but cold weather is what you need. And then when you kill these hogs, quarter them out, you take the insides out of them. And my mother was always ready. You got a tub of the insides, intestines out of these things, and that was shit ain't Molly's job. They would clean all the casings for all of the intestines and make hog casings for sausage. And you'd scrape these casings out. You first clean all the inside of them, and you turn them wrong side out, take a stick, turn them wrong side out with a stick, and then you scrape the inside of them, and you cleaned them and scraped them and washed them in clear water. And then they was ready to case sausage in. And you cased the sausage in the casing when it was turned wrong side out, which would have a slick reel inside. There wouldn't be any leaf lard on it if you had it turned wrong side out. And it kept this sausage casing good. Then we, of course, made head cheese.
What is that?
Head cheese is where you take the head and clean the head. You cut the jowls off of it and make bacon out of the jowls. That's each side of the cheekbone of a hog's head. And then you took the rest of the head and you cooked it, boiled it, and got it done. And then you peeled all the meat off the bone and mixed it with seasoning and put it in the inside of the paunch. The paunch is the stomach of the hog. You took this stomach and you cleaned it out good and turned it wrong side out, and you filled it full of this head cheese and sewed up the opening. And this was the head cheese and a few of the other pieces of the meat chopped up in there. All of the head meat, and it was spiced and seasoned and put inside this paunch and laid on a big table and pressed with a big flat rock on top of it. And when it ended up, it was about 4 inches thick, and the size of the paunch of the hog determined the big round of it, but it made it just like cheese. Usually it was about a foot to 14 inches across and about 3 to 4 inches thick. And after that was pressed out for, say, a week, and everything was set, you could just slice that off and make it made one of the best lunch meats there was.
You didn't have to cook it?
No place. Cooked his head, boiled it before, and took all the meat off the bones. It was already cooked. Just about the same type of stuff that you get in a lunch meat today.
Okay. But the stomach wasn't cooked, was it?
No, the stomach wasn't cooked, but it cured out with the rest of it, and it was just thin as paper.
Just like the casing.
Yeah, just like the casing. You could either, if you wanted to cook this head cheese, you could fry it, or you could heat it like you do lunch meat today. But my, that head cheese was good. And then they made liver sausage and blood sausage. I never did think too much of that blood sausage. They catch all the blood, and then they cook it, cook the blood, and mix some of the liver with it, and the heart, and a few other pieces.
Part 2 of the Arnold S. Griffin Family Memoirs.
I think they're both recording. I think we stopped along there about where we was fooling with that blood sausage. Did I explain the situation about the other sausage yet in this deal?
Liver sausage.
This liver sausage, but I haven't got to where we was making sausage. Really? We used to grind sausage out of the cut off parts of the hog and the waste, what most people would say was the waste part of the hog, the trimmings off of the ham, the side of bacon. You trimmed them all up and you cut off part of that, and part of it went into the lard and part of it into the sausage. We made a garlic sausage. Now this garlic sausage we cased in these casings. We first ground all the sausage meat up off of the hams and the joes, and sometimes we'd cut up one whole shoulder in the sausage meat, so we'd have lots of sausage. We like lots of sausage. Then we would take this meat and grind it up in the sausage bill and spread it out on the table, and then just cover it nearly completely with cayenne red pepper and black pepper, and to about every 50 pounds of meat we put a cup and a half of salt. That was pretty standard, and still is, to salt this meat. Then we'd put all the different kinds of spices, whatever spice we had, and then we'd mix that up with a hand good, and some of it tasted that way, but we always run ours back through the sausage mill, and that mixed it good. And then sometimes my mother would grab up a frying pan, a few patties of that sausage, and see how it's going to taste, because usually we hadn't killed a hog in a long time, we were pretty hungry anyhow, and she'd run out there and set that frying pan full of that pan of sausage on the fire and cook it, and then we'd all see how it tastes. If it needed a little something added to it, or we'd add to it. Couldn't take much of it away unless you mix some more meat with it. But anyhow, then we come to time to stuff this sausage. And we would have an old stuffer that had been in the family over 100 years, and we'd pull back that big hand lever and fill that, looked like a half of a boot nearly, made out of cast iron. Had a little tube on the front that put in and out, and on that you threaded the casing on that, cut it up in about a length about 2.5 feet long. Then you put all that on that little casing, you fill that boot full of the sausage meat, and then you press down on that lever with a piece of a hog skin under there so it wouldn't let any of the meat go by, and you just pushed it right through that half moon boot right into the casing. You held the end of the casing in one hand, and it just went out around and around, just cased up the prettiest you ever saw. My mother was expert on that, holding that casing and casing sausage, and my wife, Edna, is just about as good. She can really hold that sausage and case it. And then we'd hang that sausage up and smoke it. Hang it up on bars in the smokehouse and put a smoke under it, and we'd build this fire out of usually hickory. Sometimes we use corn cobs, sometimes mesquite, whatever was handy, but hickory makes the best smoke. And you fill an old tub about half full of sand, and then build a fire in there and get it to burning good, and then set it in out of this meat and put a big piece of tin over it, and the smoke come out from under that thing and smoke it. We keep the smoke under it every morning, smoke it about 3 hours, especially while there's any dampness in the air. You had to keep that sausage good and dry to keep them spoiling. And every day it dried down a little more, and 3 or 4 days it was pretty well safe as far as that's concerned. You might smoke it for a week, you might smoke it a little more. But then when wintertime was over and you still had lots of sausage left, you had to keep that sausage, and right away we put it down in a lard can. We'd bring a big can of a lard, heat it to where it was melted into an oil, and then you'd put as much sausage in there as you wanted to, and then let it cool, and it would be encased in the lard, and put the lid on it, and you had the lard and the sausage together. But comes the story of how you get the lard. There's also a waste of the sausage meat off of the hams and the shoulders and the bacon of a hog. If you cut up any sausage meat, you also trim off a lot of lard, fat. So we put that in a wash pot and cooked it. You build up a little fire and you start it pretty slow because you don't want to burn this lard. You put in, say, about a half a gallon of chopped up pieces of lard in about 3/4 inch squares, chopped up so that the heat could get to it evenly all the way around, and boil the grease out of it. You get it started, then you can fill the whole wash pot full of cut lard, cut grease, or cut fat, and keep a slow fire on it until it boils all of the grease out of the waste of the fat, which would be a crackling. And that's what they make crackling bread out of. And we eat them cracklings. They had a little bit of lean meat over it and went through that heat and fried up. Sure was good. We used to eat them cracklings while they're hot, right out of the pot. And then later on, well, Marvin Crouch, brother-in-law of mine, come into family. He was from Missouri, but he didn't know much about the hog killing business, but he learned to like it. And he was the engineer for Humble Oil Company for the pipeline over around Lytle, and he'd lay off work, come over and cook that lard. Watch the lard. You had to watch it while it was cooking and keep it stirring because you couldn't burn it. Women wanted all white lard. Didn't want any burnt lard. And he got to where he knew pretty well when this lard was done. Just about the time it got done, he'd start pulling that fire out from under it, and he'd call my mother, "Don't you think this lard's ready to take up?" And we'd all go out and look it over, because lard had to be cooked just right. If you cooked it too much, it'd be dark in color, and that didn't satisfy the women. If you didn't cook it enough, it'd have a little water in it, and it would spoil after you poured it up, and that wouldn't work. So it had to be just about right. But we never had too much trouble with it. And then you'd put it in lard cans. They was a tin can, usually held from 5 to 10 gallons apiece. And pour it up, strain the cracklings out through a muslin cloth used for a strainer, and you pour the hot grease and cracklings over that and strain them out in that clear lard into those cans and let them set. You couldn't put the lid on them while they're still hot. You usually put the lard can into a dish pan full of water with about 1 inch of water to keep the bottom of it cool while you're pouring in there. It might melt the starter out of that thing. So that way we put up our lard and our sausage and our bacon and meat for the whole year round. And everything worked pretty good. The same way with the making bread, cornbread, and stuff like that. We'd make these, have to gather the corn and feed the mules, and any corn that was good, well, we throwed it back to one side, and then on Saturday, maybe once a month, we'd shell this corn with an old hand sheller that we have and still have. Put it in a sack and take it down to the mill and make cornmeal out of it. And the miller didn't have any scales in those days. He just measured the sack, poured the corn out in the bin, and filled the sack up to the same level with cornmeal and gave it back to you. And he took his toll, that was his pay, out of the corn in that fashion. You wouldn't think that, but when the corn is in all in one piece, it stacks tighter than it does when it's ground. And he marked his sack and filled it back to the same place with cornmeal. He still had his toll, his pay for the grinding out of that. And he gave it back to you in that way, and that made the cornbread. So we pretty well raised all our corn and all of our meat and made the lard and made the soap. Now, there wasn't too much to be bought. You had to buy a little sugar, and some of them around the house, drank coffee. Not much coffee drank around my house, but used to drink good eat coffee. So Uncle Charlie, who was one of my daddy's brothers, he always went to San Antonio about once a year and come back with a lot of. He'd always bring a full bunch of bananas and 100 pounds of Arbuckle coffee in the berries, and they'd have to grind that, and parch that coffee, and then grind it to make coffee out of it. So that's about the way we lived in them days.